This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby 138.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, three Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm joining you from our Lexington, Kentucky studio, and I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 220, XM 206, and those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, you can check out all of our replays on the website as well. Now, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF helps permanently disabled riders who have given everything to the sport. If you are able to help, please visit the website pdjf.org. Now, this evening, a rider is joining us I have so much respect for. He's joining us from Pennsylvania, actually, and he's racked up over 3,800 victories with over $58 million in earnings. I would like to welcome jockey Dana Whitney. Dana, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So great to have you here on the show, Dana, and I got to say, I rode with you quite often when I would ship up to Penn National to ride, and it was always a pleasure to be with you in the jocks room, and you were just always made it a fun time, and always had a great personality, always helpful. And so, like I said, it's so great to have you here on the show. I guess you're on your way to Parks right now, yeah?
Yeah, I have a horse in for Mike Learman.
Nice, nice. So do you travel often, I suppose?
I do when I have to, but I try not to if I don't have to.
Try to stay at home, right?
Right.
Well, Dana, like I mentioned before we went on air, we'll start out the show with talking about how it all began. And you're not from the United States. You actually were born in the Philippines. Is that right?
Yeah, I was born in the Philippines. I was adopted when I was 2 weeks old. My dad that adopted me was an Air Force captain at Clark Air Force Base. And after he adopted me, he got out of the Air Force when we moved to Arkansas at the age of 2 years old. So basically, I know nothing about the Philippines. So I grew up in Arkansas.
Okay. Okay. So you don't know anything about the Philippines. But what was it like growing up in Arkansas?
Hot. It was really hot. But Arkansas is a pretty nice place. I was introduced to Oaklawn Park there. When I went to high school, me and my buddies, we'd go to the races at Oaklawn Park.
Sure. So did you think, and you were a kid at this point, did you think when you would go visit the track at Oaklawn, did you think that you would end up riding races?
No, because horse racing is not like football or soccer or baseball or anything that you can just sign up for. I always wanted to do something athletic. Actually, I thought I could get a scholarship for track, but that didn't work. My legs are too short. I tried football. I tried soccer. And, I tried my best at all those, but none of those really panned out. So I never thought of horse racing because I didn't know how to be introduced to it anyway.
Makes sense. But you were always athletic, and you said your legs were too small for track, which is very unfortunate, but at least you found the right path, definitely. So How were you introduced to the track? How were you introduced to riding, I should say?
Well, what happened, I went to college for a semester at Brigham Young University at BYU, and then after that semester was over, I went back to Arkansas, and I had gotten a job at a clothing store, and I was sizing this kid up, measuring him up for graduation. Come to find out, the kid, which his name is Jason Davis, his family was from horse racing, and the whole time they were asking me questions like, have you ever gotten on a horse? I think you might want to be a jockey, and how much do you weigh? And then the next question they asked is, do you like to make a lot of money? and then they invited me to come out to the farm and check it out, and that's how I got introduced, at least.
Wow, and you were how old at the time?
I was 22 at the time.
So you were 22, and for the first time, the idea of riding was introduced to you, and at this time, you had never been on the back of a horse?
Never.
Wow. That's...
I didn't know it was hard.
That is crazy. But like I said, you were already athletic. And what did your family do? Were they at all interested in the racetrack or anything like that?
No. I think at the time, my dad was a post office man, and my mom was a school teacher. So I grew up with nine brothers and sisters.
Wow.
None of them had anything to do. We grew up in the city, so none of them had to do with anything with horses. The closest anybody had anything to do with horses, my mom grew up on a farm when she was a kid up in Tridale, Utah. But that has nothing to do with horse racing, nothing like that.
Sure. Did you say nine brothers and sisters?
Yes, nine. I'm number six, so I'm close to the middle.
Wow, that is a very large family. My goodness. I only have two, so
yeah.
that's to me anyway, is a very large family, I suppose. But were you the only adopted child of your family?
They adopted me, and they adopted another boy. His name is Marcus. He's about 2 years younger than me. But then my mom had all the rest.
Okay, sure.
But she loves kids.
I would say you would have to love kids with nine children, right? That's
10 kids. Yeah,
that's
10.
Yeah, 10. That's wild. Wow. So let's go back to the Davis family and invited you to their farm. And at this point, you'd never ridden a horse in your life. And what did you find when you arrived there?
Well, they had to teach me how to just gallop a pony horse, and that was hard for me. I couldn't believe it. And I'd watch his brother, Tracy Davis, galloping a horse, and I was like, I want to at least learn how to do this. I can do this for free, so I want to learn how to do that. Then when I learned how to gallop, or as I was learning how to gallop, I'd watch him breeze horses. I'm like, that is really cool. I want to learn how to do that. And then when I got to the stage of breezing horses, now you got to remember, this all took a period of 2 years. Then I'd watch them come out of the gates. They have starting gates at their farm. They had a 3/4 of a mile farm, and I saw them do that, and I said, I really want to learn how to do that also. And so when I did that, then we started doing training races down at Louisiana Downs, which was 3 hours away. And then I really got addicted to it.
So you actually rode in the Louisiana Downs, the training races at this point. So you went from never sitting on the back of a horse to galloping, to breezing, to breaking out of the gate, and now you're at Louisiana Downs. That's quick progress.
Well, it took 2 years, but the funny thing was, on the farm, we thought it was funny to shape each other. We thought that was really funny. When I did that at Louisiana Downs, the jocks did not like that a little bit.
They're like, who's this young kid trying to cut us off over here?
Well, that was like Calvin Burrell, Ken Busey. Randy Romero wasn't there at the time, but trying to think of names that you might know. Shane Romero was there at the time. Weldon Clollinger. Chris Emmy, which is still riding. Those are the riders that were there at the time.
So big name Cajun riders were there, and that had to be an incredible experience to be so new to riding races anyway, and to be in the midst of these legends. That had to be an incredible experience. What did you learn there?
Well, I learned to work hard. One thing that I learned was me and Scooter. When I actually started racing, Calvin Burrell would always try to be there first. So he was the one that taught me the work ethic.
Mm.
And me and Scooter, we would try to beat him to the track because it's so hot down there. You want to be the first horse on the track. Otherwise, after the first, you know, three sets, it's too hot to even train horses.
Wow.
But, work ethic was the first thing that I needed to learn, and then learning all about the horses, their language, and what they respond to, and what they like and don't like.
Did anyone in particular take you under their wing and try to teach you exactly what you just described, the way horses communicate?
Like I said, let's see. To be honest with you, Calvin followed me because back then it was the Louisiana, Arkansas fairground circuit. And then I did so good. I went from Louisiana to the fairgrounds, and I did so good down at the fairgrounds. I went and I hit the Kentucky circuit as an apprentice rider, and I did really well there. But the person that kind of stuck with me through all those circuits was Calvin Burrell. I got introduced with Shane Sellers, and he helped me a lot. So those two, I mean, everybody helped me pretty much. I was very successful as an apprentice rider, probably because of all the help of riders I didn't know that were going to end up being, you know, Hall of Famer riders. And so I didn't know I was really learning from the best when I was learning from them.
I would definitely say so. Good riders to learn from, that's for sure. And so eventually you said you did extremely well with your apprentice, with your bug. So what did your family think when you decided to become a professional jockey?
At first, you know, they weren't really big about it because it has to do with a lot of gambling, very religious. But as I got very successful, my dad ended up being my biggest fan. I had to go to work, do his work at the post office and meet all his friends. As an apprentice rider, I got to ride the first three races on Kentucky Derby Day. So my oldest brother flew in from Utah and watched me ride those races.
Wow.
So they were very supportive after they realized I was in it 100%.
That's incredible. You just said you got to ride on the Derby undercard while you were still an apprentice. So I'm imagining that when you're going out there for the post parade and you see the big crowds and you have to get a rush from that, you have to think, one day I want to be here for the Derby.
You know, that's everybody's dream.
Yeah.
As a jockey, that's a large stepping stone and for sure. And it's, you know, I thought it was going to happen. Like next year, I was so successful, I didn't ever know anything different but riding all big races. Kind of spoiled, I guess you want to say, but I did work hard. I worked really hard when I was an apprentice rider. I would drive when I was at Churchill. I would drive to Kingland and work a horse for Pat Day, hoping that he wouldn't have to get to ride that horse.
Trying to scoop up his mounts. That's, you got to work hard.
Everybody has to do that.
You got to work hard. That's a lot of miles were put on your car at the time, I'm sure. You mentioned, Dana, that your family is very religious, and did that help you? Obviously, riding is a very dangerous profession, and did that help you having that, I suppose, peace of mind when you go out there and an ambulance follows you around the track every day?
You know what's really funny? I had an accident I should not have got up from. And when I was walking back to the jock room, all the jockeys were standing there at the front doorway wondering how I was walking. And one of the jocks said, how are you able to get back? How are you able to get back after an accident like that? And it just came out of my mouth that, you know, I paid my tithing. I pay my tithing every Sunday. And it's like an extra insurance. So, yes, when I'm out there, I feel that I'm protected by our Heavenly Father. And I do have that extra comfort because of my religion.
So what exactly happened in that spill you just described?
My horse had broken leg, and it was a matter where when a horse goes down, sometimes you get those easy falls, and sometimes you get those really hard falls where you just don't get up. And it was a matter where I think I landed face first, like a dart into the track. And somehow, some way, I was able to brush off and walk right back to the jock room. You know, I've had more than one incidences where I should have been hauled off by the ambulance, or maybe could be even worse. And I've always been fortunate enough to get back and get back into the saddle and continue to do what I do.
Thank goodness for that. What injuries have you had? That particular instance, you were able to walk away, but as we all know, broken bones are inevitable. So what injuries have you had, Dana?
Well, I did have an accident, and I don't remember the accident, where I broke my back and my neck and shattered my left arm to where now all in my forearm it has two bones. Those bones have been replaced with rods and plates and screws. And that was my worst accident. Maybe I broke some ribs too, but and if you asked me what happened, I couldn't even tell you.
Wow. Where was that at?
That was at Mountaineer at the time.
Gosh. Back and neck all at once, and then rods in your arm. Do you set off the alarms at the airport, Dana?
I don't. I thought I might. but, of course, the doctor said if you do, all you have to do is put your cards on the arm, and they'll let you go through.
Well, that's good. Thank goodness that security's not chasing after you through the airport. My gosh.
I know. Airports can be tough now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I asked that question because I had the same concern when I got my ceramic hip, but I don't set off any alarms either. So we're all good there. But Dana, so let's rewind a little bit. You killed him with your apprentice, with your bug, and you were at the Kentucky circuit, and where did you go from there?
Well, after that, you try to find that perfect spot where you fit in. And when you lose your apprentice, of course, you're going to know you're going to lose half your business. And so I went back to Oakland once. I went back to the fairgrounds. I went to Hoosier Park before, and then somebody, I can't remember, I think Steve Elzey had mentioned, why don't you try Beulah Park? You have all the strong connections from Kentucky. He knew my goal was I wanted to be a leading rider, because as an apprentice, even though I was doing well, I was always in the top five or top ten, and he knew I wasn't happy enough with that I wanted that title. I just wanted a leading riding title. He said, go over there and see how that works. I'll send you all the Kentucky business. And I think I got two leading riding titles there.
Nice.
While I was there.
So that goal was accomplished. Was that had to be a pretty good feeling when you received the award at the end of the meet for the very first time? Yeah.
It got addictive. It made me. one thing that about me, I'm never satisfied. So then I had another opportunity that was at Mountaineer. Mountaineer had just gotten slots at their place, and the same scenario, go there, we'll send you all the business over there. At the peak time of Mountaineer, I think you're claiming five, which was the bottom pot or bottom purse at the time was $15,000 for claiming five. The allowance was going for 45.
Wow.
And I came in there with a lot of ammo and a lot of leading riding titles out there.
Nice. I have to say, Dana, when I was researching you for the show, I was, of course, Googling your name and all that good stuff, and not a lot of information about you. I have to say you're a bit of a man of mystery, but what did come up was a lot of information from Mountaineer about how successful you were there, and like you said, obviously you won several leading rider titles there. How long did you ride there?
Mountaineer, I was there for 10 years, I want to say. It was about 10 years, 10 really good years. Maybe a little bit more, but about 10 good solid years.
That's a long time. That's a long time for a jockey who, you know, we're kind of known as gypsies a little bit. So that's a long time to be in one place riding. And what did you like about the track there? I've never actually been to Mountaineer.
Oh, you haven't?
Never been.
Well, when I first got there, I almost turned around and left because it's not your Kentucky circuit. Yeah. It's not your Oakland park, and it's not any of the tracks that I've ever seen before. But as I got there, I decided to stay there. The money started going up, and when I started my family, I realized that this is a year-round track, and I didn't have to move four times a year or five times a year, that I could actually be a father and be a jockey at the same time. That's what I liked about Mountaineer.
That makes perfect sense. A somewhat steady, normal routine and schedule. You said when you were thinking about starting a family. So tell us, I saw something on Facebook where you and your wife were just celebrating 19 years of marriage, I believe it was. And that is a huge milestone. And tell us how you met your wife.
Well, my best friend from high school, his name is Zach Riley. He was getting married, and he was getting married to a girl that went to our high school also, Legal Riley. My wife lived across the street from her. At the wedding, I met my wife at that wedding, asked her out. So this was about right about the same time I started training for racing, about the same time I met the Davis family. And so she was with me pretty much the whole time learning to be a jockey. And we got married. Actually, we got married. We were on our honeymoon when Billy Davis, who is the Davis family father, called me and said, you need to get over to Louisiana down to get your license and start riding.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we were, you know, halfway into the honeymoon, but we didn't know anybody where we were at, so we just cut it short, went straight to Louisiana. I got my license, and we're still married. It's 20 years married.
20 years. That is an awesome lady you have, Dana, who will cut her honeymoon short to head to Louisiana Downs. That is a fantastic, fantastic story. That's incredible. Well, Dana, we are right about at the half point mark here, and we're going to head to a quick commercial break. And when we get back, I would love to talk more about your family. So we'll continue our visit with jockey Dana Whitney after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Pena, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Florent Giroux made the most out of his limited mounts as he prepares for Saratoga. Giroux won the Grade 1 Delaware Handicap aboard I'm a Chatterbox and finished the week with 3 wins and 1 second place finish from 7 mounts. Irad Ortiz Jr. finished the Belmont meet strong as he finished in the money on 55% of his mounts. Ortiz Jr. finished the week with 7 wins, 8 seconds, and 3 third-place finishes. Irad's brother Jose Ortiz wrapped up the Belmont riding title by an impressive 21 victories over Irad. Jose won 3 of his 5 stakes mounts, highlighted by a win in the Grade 3 Kent Stakes aboard American Patriot. Ortiz finished the week with 12 wins, 4 seconds, and 5 thirds from 33 mounts. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Rafael Bejarano, wrapped up another Santa Anita riding title and continued his hot streak into the Del Mar meet. Bejarano traveled to Indiana on Saturday to win the Grade 2 Indiana Derby aboard Cupid and then caught a flight back to Del Mar on Sunday to win the Grade 2 Eddie Reed aboard Midnight Storm. Bejarano finished the week with 3 wins, 2 seconds, and 1 third-place finish. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, explores everything that goes into winning a race from the rider's perspective. How do jockeys land mounts? How do they plan strategy? What are jockeys thinking and trying to do as the race unfolds? The book answers those questions and many more. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I am Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Dana Whitney. And Dana, before we went to the break, we were talking about your lovely wife, and you've been married for 20 years, and what an incredible story that is. And do you have kids?
I have 4 boys.
4 boys. Wow, your wife becomes even more incredible in my eyes as you continue to talk. That's
well,
awesome.
The reason why I have 4 because I wanted a boy and a girl, and so I had a boy and a boy, and then I tried for a girl again, and I got a boy, and I tried for a girl again, and got a boy, and now we're done.
And now you're done? Are you sure? Maybe fifth time the charm, you know?
Well, we decided that, you know, I was adopted, my wife was adopted, and one way to be for sure if we want to have a girl later on down the road, we would just adopt one.
Oh, that's awesome. So your wife is adopted as well. So is that maybe, you know, maybe when you two first met, did you have that bond, I suppose, that connection you could talk about? Is that maybe part of why you two first got together?
That could be, you know, one of many reasons. You know, I married her because of many, many reasons. But I'm sure that definitely would be a tide that we can relate to, for sure.
Right, right. That's incredible. That's incredible. So you're four boys and your lovely wife, and you were just talking about how Mountaineer was a place you wanted to settle down at. You stayed there for 10 years because you had your family, and you said you almost left, but then you decided to stay, and it was the purses were so great. What eventually made you decide to leave there?
Well, as you know, when you have a casino and horse racing, they're bound by contracts. And I was watching the contracts that get renewed every year. They would lose 10% here, there, and I could kind of foresee that they were running out of their contracting power. So the purses were slowly going back to the point where when I first came into Mountaineer, and when you ride for low purse money, you're going to ride dangerous horses. And what happened was Todd Beatty used to run at Mountaineer all the time, and another trainer called John Zimmerman used to run at Mountaineer all the time. I was super successful there with them and their horses, that they were trying to get me to go to Penn National for, I would say, 4 years.
Wow.
And then finally, when I watched the last purse drop at Mountaineer, I said, now it's time to go. As soon as I left Mountaineer, I don't know what their bottom purse money is, but it's pretty low now.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, Mountaineer has been good to me, and I've done very well there, but it was time to make that change.
That's definitely understandable, given, you know, you're going out there risking your life every day anyway, no matter what track you're at, so you might as well go somewhere where the purse money is much better. And so I guess you packed your bags and you headed to Penn National. And what did you think of Penn when you first got there?
Well, I had shipped into Penn National one time prior to this, before they had their remodeling done. And it was for Bernie Flynn, a Kentucky trainer that I rode for. And the only thing that I could remember is it was dark. It was kind of dark. They ran at night like Mountaineer, but my experience wasn't really great. My horse bled that day, so I wasn't successful there. I just didn't feel comfortable there, and so it took the full 4 years before I eventually moved out. What happened was my agent, John Krulock, had got with Todd Beatty, and they gave me a pretty good pitch, and it just happened to be at the right time to move out that way. And you know, I talk to my wife now, and we don't regret the move a little bit.
That's awesome. That's awesome, Dana. And obviously, it picked up from that first time that you rode there, and your horse bled, and all kinds of things. But obviously, you're one of the leading riders there, and you've had multiple leading rider titles at Penn National. And like I said during the intro, that's where I know you from. I would ship into Penn frequently, and like I said, you always had just such a great attitude. You made it fun, and it was just so much fun riding with you there at Penn National. But tell me, having a family, and you said Mountaineer was, of course, night racing as well, and then you moved to Penn, which is also night racing. Having a family, is that difficult to be riding at night, and then you have to get up and work horses in the morning, and you must be very busy?
You just have to pick your routine. The important thing is, as long as I can see them a little bit every day, and always be there for them when it's needed. That's the most important thing. When we're separated, like when I came out to Penn National to try it out, I was out here for about a year, and I could feel my family falling apart.
So, Dana, does your family go to the races frequently?
Not as much as they used to. they're very busy now themselves with all the sports that my kids are in, because my youngest is 11, my oldest is 18 now.
Wow.
My wife is also involved with a lot of church activities, as well as soccer mom and all the responsibilities the mother has to do. But they do come out on occasion to watch specific races, or to come out with when a lot of my friends or acquaintances want to go to the races. They'll go out there and hang out and have fun at the races then.
Do any of your kids express interest in riding?
Maybe the youngest one.
Really?
He's pretty small. My oldest one is too heavy, and his name is Bryce. Grant's probably going to be too heavy. He's going to be bigger than Bryce. Mason is going to be way too heavy. Spencer's a tiny guy, and he's the only one that might show some interest, but I'm not going to push it on him, not even a little bit.
No, not even a little bit. What would you do if they said, would you try to maybe convince them otherwise if they said they would like to ride, or would you be supportive of that decision?
Well, I would discourage them for sure, and I would push for education first, and if they can overcome the discouragement, then I'll be there for them.
Right.
I'll be there for them 100%.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And why would that be? Would you be worried about their safety and how tough of a business it is? I mean, it is, you know, a grueling, very tough industry. Is that the reason why you would discourage that?
Well, you're always going to be worried about their safety. But for the most part, horse racing is still an old school job. You know, it's very demanding. It's something like, as well as you know, when you're asked to be somewhere for morning workouts, you need to be there probably 10 minutes early.
Exactly.
It's old school hard work. Mm-hmm. And they need to know that they need to be very dedicated if they want to do this. That I don't want them to test the waters. Either they jump in with both feet or they don't do it at all.
That's exactly how it has to be when you decide to ride. You've described it perfectly. You can't be, maybe, we'll see how this is. You know, you got to be all
right.
In or all out. There's no in between, because it's so demanding and so tough that there's no other way to do it. You have to be that fully committed to doing it. And speaking of committed, Dana, in August of 2010, you won your 3,000th race. That had to be an incredible feeling.
It was a very incredible feeling. It's not something that a lot of people do. When I won my 3,000th race, I was reflecting about the time that I started and how late of a start that I got, and just feeling blessed at how successful I've been for the short amount of time that I've been riding. And then I was thinking for my next milestone, which is 4,000, which is kind of right around the corner.
Yeah.
It's all about being able to keep your heart, love what you do, stay healthy. And I don't have that bad issue, but those are the factors in keeping your weight down. So those are the three main factors that you need to continue to ride this far into your career.
It's an incredible feat, that's for sure, Dana, and I can't even imagine the gratification that must have brought to you. And like you said, 4,000 is just right around the corner. What other goals do you have still to accomplish in your riding career?
Well, you're always looking for that big horse.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's hard to look for that big horse when you stay at Pitt National. So I need to make every race count. Of course, when I was a Mountaineer, I ran across Western Pride. Mm-hmm. And with that horse, I won the West Virginia Derby, I won the Ohio Derby, and I won the Hialeah Derby in Florida. And I finished fourth in the California Derby. So it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to stay sharp and stay on top of the game like you said, you have to stay positive, and the attitude is everything. So definitely looking for the big horse. I've got numbers, but I always want the quality over quantity.
Definitely. No, looking for that next Western Pride. Tell us about that horse. You beat me to the punch. I was actually going to bring that horse up, and you found so much success together, and that's incredible. You found him at Mountaineer, and then you go on and do great things together. What kind of a horse was he to ride?
Well, he was a front runner, and at the time at Mountaineer, I used to ride for a trainer who had passed away. His name was Dale Baird, and he was all about being a front-running jockey. So I knew how to come out of the gate. And one thing about that horse, he loved being in front. And I knew how to ride horses that like to be in that position. So I was able to take advantage of it because I was always a long shot. Nobody wants to be heads up with a long shot. But behind that long shot, he had a lot of class that got you to the wire before anybody else.
Wow, you just dig in, and that's an incredible feeling to be on one like that. And how do you do that, Dana? Because I always admired, I noticed just what you described at Penn National. You were so good on the front end, getting those horses to relax. And without divulging all of your secrets, what exactly do you do to get those front runners to relax like that?
Well, like you asked, what did I need to learn as a finish rider? What was one of the most important things? And listening to your horse is so important. Every horse will tell you something, and if you just sit there and listen to them, you can hear what they want. As far as getting a horse to relax up at the front, I do different things with different horses to get it. There's two or three different things, but the one main thing is, I don't know if you know the term, I like to take a long rope on them. Mm-hmm. And you can hold them back a little bit without choking the run out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's my number one thing. I like to take a long hold, and that'll relax them. You should have finish at the end when you do it that way.
That definitely makes sense, Dana. The shorter grip you have, the more they want to go. So it definitely makes sense, that long, you know, that long hold. That's by far the best way to get that done. But Dana Whitney joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Dana, what do you like to do for fun? I was stalking your Facebook page the other day when I was preparing for the show, I will admit. And I see, and it makes sense, because you said that you almost got a scholarship for track, but it looks to me like you're an avid runner, and you also seem to like paintball a lot. I don't know if that's true, but tell us what you like to do for fun.
I have to be careful because I like a little bit of everything. I love hunting. I love fishing. I love to go snow skiing. If there's anything out there and I haven't tried it, it's probably going to be on my bucket list. But there's not too much I don't like. I just like to be moving. I like to compete, whatever. I just finished our 2016 challenge. Me, my wife, and another lady was going against another team, and the goal is to run 2016 miles collectively in the year 2016.
Wow.
Well, our team finished in June.
Wow.
And so we're done. So right now my kids are chasing Pokemon, and we got up early this morning and we ran 6 miles chasing Pokemon.
All right, Dana, so please enlighten me on what exactly the Pokemon craze is all about. I'm lost. I don't even know what's going on there.
Well, I'm not a big Pokemon fan either. I don't really know all that much about Pokemon, but all I do know is that it was getting my kids up out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning they would go out and come back 6 miles later.
Wow.
And so that got my interest, and I wanted to know what's getting my kids up there running 6 miles a day. And so I downloaded the app, and they have to teach me all this stuff. But what there are Pokemon stations. You run to the stations and collect balls that catches Pokemon. And
wow.
Between the stations, Pokemon pop up all over the place, and you catch them.
Well, there we go. I would, yeah. That's, you know what, if it's getting kids out, you know, and running 6 miles, it has to be a good thing. That's funny.
There's some crazy stories out there, but with every good thing, there's going to be a few bad things.
Yeah, sure, exactly. But like I said, you know, it's getting kids out of the house, and that's really funny, though. All I hear about is Pokemon this, Pokemon that, and I was glad you could clear that up for me a little bit, Dana. But anyway, Dana Whitney joining me here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Dana, you mentioned something a couple minutes ago in regards to what it takes to find so much success and to ride for, you know, a long time. And you mentioned your weight, and you said you don't really have to worry about it too much. I assume, is that right?
Yeah, as long as I stay about 113, I'm plenty happy. And the way I do that is I move.
Yeah.
I move on to doing something. And I've learned that through the period of time that I've been riding, as long as I stay pretty active, I can stay pretty light.
Pokemon. Start doing the Pokemon, that'll keep you moving.
Pokemon's my new thing after I did the 2016 challenge. That's yes. Done and gone.
There we go. You're breaking records all over the place, Dana. I love it. I love it. What else? Do you focus on... Do you go to the gym, or do you have to worry about that? Or you probably ride enough that you don't really have to worry about lifting weights or anything like that, I'm assuming.
No, but you always want to stay on top of the game. I always want to be as fit or fitter than any rider in the room. So, but I always run regardless of what's going on. I'm going to run, you know, it might be 6 miles, 4 miles, or even 2 miles. But I'm going to be running every day if I'm not doing anything.
So, Dana, I got to ask you this question because I wondered this many, 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 many times when I would ship into Penn, and it's January, and it's freezing cold, and I'm all bundled up, and I'm just shivering. And I'm like, man, how do these guys do this every day? Because it is... I would go out on a limb and say that's the coldest place on earth I've ever been, especially on the back of a horse going, you know, 35 miles an hour. How do you stay warm? How do you do it? The year round racing that's at Penn National, going out there in the brutal weather conditions sometimes, and mostly referring to the cold weather. Anyway, how do you stay warm?
That's a tricky one, because the main thing that I really worry about, I just want to just stay warm enough in order to maintain my horse. Mm. If he needs to be pulled in this direction, I need my hands to be able to feel my hands to pull him to the left or pull him to the right or to slow him down. But one thing I do, like if it's really cold and we're talking, you know, with the wind chill factors 0 degrees, I will wrap my feet with plastic. Mm. Another thing I like to do is aspirin. It thins the blood, and when your blood is thin, it circulates throughout the body, and that helps keep you warm also.
Really? I did not know that. Oh, my gosh. I wish I would have known when I was riding. That is a new trick I've never heard of before. That's very interesting. That's right. If I ever decide to
it works.
to make a comeback and ride in the cold weather. I will remember that most definitely, Dana. That is interesting. That is very interesting. And how do you, so we covered the cold. How do you prepare for a race now? Do you handicap thoroughly? Do you watch replays? Do you talk to the other jockeys that maybe rode the horse before? What do you do with that?
Well, what I do, since you don't ride at Penn Nationals, it's hard for you to see my routine. But I usually go in the jock's room 3 hours prior to the race. And when it's game time, I like to have all my ducks in the order. I already have a game plan for every horse. And if I don't know the horse, if the replays permit, I'm watching the replays. I'm watching to see if he's lugging in or getting out, if he doesn't like the inside. I'm just trying to learn what the horse likes and doesn't like. And then I like to see how the race is going to at least play out the first quarter of the mile. Just basically know, I like to have my game plan way before the race starts.
You like to be prepared, and of course, we all know that you can have a plan, and when the gates open, sometimes it doesn't always work that way, but it's always helpful anyway to know your horse, but also the other horses in the race, so you know what they're going to do, and also the other jockeys in the race. And do you do that as well? Do you focus on the riders and maybe think about what the riders, what their tendencies are?
That is so important. If I ship into a track where I don't know a few riders, that might be the very first question I'm going to ask is, how is that rider right there?
Mm-hmm.
How is, like, and I'm sure I've asked about you. I'm like, can she hold the turn, you know?
Yeah.
Or does she blow the turns? Because if you're going to blow the turns, I'll probably be sitting right behind you, and when you blow it, I'm going to get such a big key on making or not making a race happen.
No, that's so true, and that's sometimes more important than the horse's tendencies, because the rider is the one on top there making it happen. But that's definitely true. And like you said, it is tricky whenever you are shipping out of town, and that's, you know, kind of what they say about the home field advantage. You have the advantage when you're at your home track and you already know everyone, but when you ship out of town, it's a little more different. But like today, you're going to Parks, but you go to Parks frequently, so your race today, you probably have it all figured out, and you already probably know the riders there as well, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and it, let's say I go to a is I got to come in there and I got to ride the smart race, do the right thing.
Yeah, ride a smart race, Dana. That's definitely sure. We only have a couple minutes left here, Dana. You mentioned that you came up under the legends like Calvin Burrell and Shane Sellers, and how they stress the importance of hard work. And of course, you've worked so hard over the years, as your success shows. But working in the morning, and again, Penn National is a little bit different because they have night racing, and so I never rode there year round, so I don't know how often the jocks go out and work horses in the morning. But is that, do you go out every morning, and is it pretty busy?
From what I've heard, now you rode a park. I think the riders go out a little bit more at parks than they do at Penn National. The mentality at Penn National, they don't abuse the riders too much. And I mean, what I mean by that, they don't have the riders gallop horses for their mounts. My clients don't require me too much morning workouts. There are some days I come out every day, and then there might be some days that I'm required to come out and work horses 3 days of the week. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to come out and do some PR mm-hmm. and check up on the horses that ran previously. I like to check up on some of the horses that might not have ran up to par, and find out if there was any reason for that. Maybe they might have pulled up bad, or maybe they had mucus in their system, or maybe they have bled. But sometimes I like to just go back and check up on my horses when they don't run the part, or when they run really good. I just want to make sure that they come back good also.
That makes perfect sense. And like you said, kind of PR work, so they don't forget your face. You don't go out there, out of sight, out of mind kind of situation. And
right.
Who's your agent, and how important is an agent to you? And describe to our audience what exactly an agent does.
Okay. My agent's John Krulot. And as far as the importance of the game, that's probably the most important part of the game. The agent gives you the opportunity to let you make your talent happen. You can't make it something happen if you're not given those opportunities. So what an agent does, you have a field of 12 horses. It's his job to find the best horse of those 12. Now, let's say that best horse is taken. Then he goes for the next best or the next best. But the agent's job is to find the fastest horse or the best horse for that race at that time.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's so incredibly important to have a good agent, and of course, a good agent wants a good rider. So you and your agent, Dana, are quite the team there at Penn National. And I tell you what, we are right about out of time here. And, hey, good luck at Parks today. I will be watching and cheering you on, Dana.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll take the luck. It's always good to be good, but it's better to be lucky.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. Dana, thank you so much. Wishing you all the best. Now, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. You will find a full schedule and all of the replays for every show we bring to you here at the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go check it out, horseracingradio.net. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.